listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flueckiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to this episode of LA Talk Radio, Your Ultimate Life. This is a show that's committed to helping you create a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy. And I get the wonderful chance today to bring on a special guest from Australia, Jim Fuller, who is a world-changing dude. And I'm not going to give an introduction because I never do, but it'll all come out as we have this conversation. Jim, welcome to the show.
Kellen, thank you so much for having me on your show.
You are welcome. You are welcome. As you know, your show, The Ultimate Life, is about the true and honest possibility of creating a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy, and not just talking about it or imagining it or wishing for it and all the rest of the stuff. So let me start with a loaded question. So tell me, Jim, without being modest or honest, tell the audience, how does Jim choose with his time, effort, love, resources, to add good to the world?
Well, over the last couple of years, what's been really gripping my attention, my passion, and my drive and my energy has been building out the global ecosystem around the center of love. The center of love is both a physical place that we're raising to build in the Himalayan mountains, a very special place in the Himalayan mountains. So it's an education sanctuary that we're building, and it's also a metaphor for being the center of a global network of education sanctuaries, a center of love hubs around the world, where we will be re-educating very senior leaders to go back into their sectors and embed a human coherence pro forma into the sectors to help us all navigate the very, very near future with AI, which I know is something that you're very interested in as well, Kellen, and really to address the human existential pending crisis of meaning. Why am I here? If AI is doing all the knowledge and the productivity stuff, how am I valuable and what is my place? And that's something that we're very interested in helping humanity navigate.
So because you're so deep in this, like any expert, you've used a bunch of words that are mean something to you, and I understand them, but I want to dig into a couple of them. So you want to talk to senior leaders about doing what different? Like, what do we need to do different to navigate, you called it an existential crisis, which is like, you know, an extinction event emotionally or spiritually. I don't think it's threatening us with imminent death, maybe, but tell me more about that. Like, dig right in and tell me what it means to change. What do we got to do?
So over the last chapters of humans in work, We have developed our sense of value. How much am I worth in my profession or in my work? How much am I worth based on my knowledge, so my experience, my years of experience, and how productive am I? So I get paid more the more I know and the more I produce. That paradigm is about to be shifted. AI will know more than any one individual person could know. And also working 24/7 at lightning speed will be way more productive than any human could be. And I believe that for us to remain relevant in the workplace and not only relevant, but hopefully more valuable, will be in our human to human coherence. When we come into coherence with each other is a mixture of empathy and compassion and love and connection and rapport. And it's a biological feature that AI can't replicate. It's something that AI won't be able to replace for us. We've all got it inherently within us. It's organically, it's in our DNA. It's how we evolved as a species. If we didn't figure out how to work together in societies, as a village, if we didn't figure out how to work together as teams, we would never have evolved off the savannah plains, right? We need each other. But in the recent chapters, we've forgotten that. And so to give a real life example, a general practicing doctor, I mean, at least here in Australia, and I'm guessing it's the same in Canada and the States, a doctor has got to the point where they diagnose and prescribe as quickly as possible. They get the patient in the door, they take their temperature, they write them a script for an antibiotic and get them out, and they turn over as many patients as possible. There's no relationship going on. It's a diagnose, prescribe situation. AI already, but it will be rolled out en masse. AI will diagnose and prescribe way more effectively and accurately than any doctor ever could. So what I'm arguing is that the doctor's place will be in the relationship, to be able to become present with the patient and to deeply care about them as a person, as an individual, to breathe in time with them, to come into a deep sense of rapport with them, and to heal through the relationship in conjunction with using the AI. So the doctor, of course, will use the AI and prescribe the best medicine and also have time to go into relationship with the patient and use that human connection as part of the what they do. And you can translate that example into any profession. You know, if you're an accountant and all you do is crunch numbers and put tax returns together, you're out of a job. But if you're an accountant and you care about your clients on a personal level, I believe you'll still have some relevance.
So this is going to require, and I know you know this and you've said it, a radical shift in the people that are presently doing. So your doctor and your accountant, who today couldn't give a crap, in fact, don't have time to care, because the it's what you said, in and out, in and out, in and out. And I, you know, the doctor I see says right on the wall, appointments are scheduled for 15 minutes. And so you've got 15 minutes to do everything from, hi, how you doing? What's going on? To why are you here? To poke, prod, do whatever it is. Okay, let's try this. Bye. And it says on the same wall, if you have more than one thing to talk about, you better schedule two appointments. So like a literal representation. So what's going to have to happen to the accountant or the lawyer or the doctor to internally to develop a whole new set of skills? I mean, they went to medical school for four and then intern for three. And if they're specialized, three or four more. And none of that was in the curriculum. So what's going to have to happen to those practitioners to manage this?
The first thing that has to happen, I'm not what our work, the project, we're not going to have to actually do. The first thing that has to happen, and the first thing that has to happen, is that the current paradigm needs to be so shaken up. The apple cart has to be so shaken that they cannot exist in the old way. They won't have work. If they insist on holding on to the old way of doing things, they will not have a job, right? So there's going to be a big shakeup, whether people like it or not. And if this was 10 years ago and I had this idea for the Center of Love and we're going to build a love curriculum and get it into the structures that form the sectors of our societies, and there was no pending massive change coming, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But someone said to me the other day, Jem, how are you going to get the executive director of the head of the Department of Education, Victoria, Australia, how are you going to get them to want to change or want to come on a program or want to embed this stuff? And I said to them, the shakeup that's coming is coming whether they like it or not. And I don't have to do the shakeup. The shakeup's coming because of the advancements in AI. And then to your next question of how will they have time to invest in a relationship, because the patient will walk into the clinic, put their finger inside a little thing, and within 30 seconds, the AI will know exactly where they're at medically and what they need. The doctor won't even be needed for that. Then what the doctor will need to do is communicate that in an interpersonal way, hopefully with some emotional intelligence, hopefully with some compassion and care and some conscious communication stuff that happens between humans. So the doctor will have all of the stuff. They won't need to sit there and do a diagnosis, which takes most of the time. They'll have all the time, those 15 minutes, to sit and drop into a place of coherence. Now, how to do that bit, that's the bit that we're proposing that we will teach. And we've actually developed some innovative ways using AI and wearable AI tech, along with a very simple pro forma. And I believe because it's already in us, in our DNA, it's a remembering. It's not a learning a whole brand new thing. It's an invocation of something that exists within us organically anyway, which is our ability to connect with each other, and that we catalyze or reignite that through the simple teachings that we have.
So what you're saying is, hello, people, We bastardized all this other stuff this old way. Too bad. Now something is forcing us to change, and now you're finally going to have both permission and encouragement to be the human of humannesses that you somewhere in you wanted to be, and maybe it was beat out of you, and you'll have a little repair work or remembering to do, but you're now going to be not only have permission, but required by the changes, and hopefully it is more a sigh of relief as opposed to a gigantic dance of fear that they have to learn these new things. And so the fact that it took you 10 years to be a doctor doesn't matter. It might take you, a couple of weeks to reallow the humanness to be present. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, to some degree. And I think there'll be, I'm not an economist, but the very basic fundamentals of, especially in the private sector, but in the public sector to some degree, I think that possibly it will come to a point where if you don't remember or retrain yourself on how to do relationship really well, you won't have a job. You won't have work. And the people who are good at relationship, I think will become even more valuable. The in-person shared felt experience will become even more valuable. If, for example, you're a musician, there's been a struggle for original artists who make music. It's been a struggle for them as technology has advanced to the point now where, an AI band was formed and went onto Spotify and was in the top charts for ages, and no one knew they were all AI, and everyone was clicking on their songs and loving their songs. When they came out and said, "This is not real humans, this is all AI," they fell off the charts. Right? Interesting. Humans want to feel a connection to another human, whether it's creating art or music, or whether it's a doctor who cares about me as a person, or whether it's my accountant who I go and have lunch with every month and we sit down and eat Japanese together and he asks me about my kids, or whether it's the shared felt experience of going on a retreat with someone in person, or collecting at a summit or a gathering, or going to Pilates and having a Pilates instructor with human touch who helps you through your therapeutic movement, say, for example. I think that these things will become even more valuable.
So I agree with you, and I'm asking these questions not because I disagree, because that's the fundamental piece that we're talking about on the podcast that we're doing about coaching, is a similar a value proposition. So now let's dig into Jim. So you here are the champion of love. You're the champion of a return to humanity. You're the champion of us remembering how to be with each other and to exist in love and coherence. You've used a couple of times. Tell me the story. Like, you didn't fall up this mountain. So how did you get to where this is both your passion and your prediction?
Well, I mean, I think one of the fundamental pieces of how I got to being who I am, where I am now, is that for whatever reasons, and I have dived very deeply into the psychology of my relationship with my father, but I'm not going to take up our time talking about that, but that is where it all began. But I was a reaction to my father and didn't want to be him. He was a beautiful man, and he was a lovely human being who did a lot for the communities that he was a part of. But I was a reaction against him, and he was very conservative, and so I became anti-establishment. When I was a teenager, I was piercing my ears and shaving mohawks and, getting tattoos and just wanting to be anti-establishment. But I was always very peaceful. I was always a very gentle boy and gentle man. So I wasn't an aggressive anti-establishment punk. I was a very peaceful, passive, pot-smoking, anti-establishment punk, for want of a better word. And so as soon as I finished high school, I left. I just went as far away as I could from what the norm was. When everybody else was going to college or university and getting a job and putting on a shirt and a tie, I went as far away from that as I could. And I went and lived in the backwaters of remote foreign countries like India and Pakistan and Tibet and Bangladesh and Southeast Asia. And not just for a holiday, for a way of life, all through my 20s. and spent a lot of time curious about other cultures and curious about spirituality and the meaning of life and all the big questions. A lot of contemplation, a lot of meditation, a lot of wandering around barefoot and dreadlocked, trying to figure it all out. And so then my experience in the Western world came when I became a dad in my early 30s and I had kids to feed. So I needed to get a job. So I went and ended up putting on a shirt and tie and experienced 8 years in the corporate world. So then I understood I'd had experience in both worlds, from fire dancer and tattooist to corporate leader. And that then enabled me to be a bridge between those two worlds and to help us bring some of the ancient wisdoms and understandings into the modern context, into the corporate space. So my bread and butter work for the last 15 years as a coach has been coaching in the corporate space, coaching leaders. But in the last couple of years, when we were gifted some land in the Himalaya by my family over there, my adopted family over there, has been really my passion has been around this more global nonprofit work.
So there's a whole story there you just glossed over in one sentence. How did you get gifted some land in the Himalayas? Like, if I'm walking down the street with an average dude, even in Australia, he's not going to say in an offhand way, "Oh yeah, I got gifted some land in the Himalayas." I mean, that's not going to come out of his mouth. So you went through this thing in your 20s, you decided for whatever reason to have a relationship and have a kid or more. How many kids do you have?
I've got two boys.
All right. So you have a couple of boys and suddenly it's like, okay, I'm not going to feed them good vibes. I have to feed them some food and we have to have a place to live and et cetera, et cetera. So you took on a new path and became a leader. I guess I have two questions. One is about the land, but what did you find that allowed you to do that transition to put on the shirt and tie and to go be something else? And how did that barefoot dreadlock time prepare you for corporate leadership?
Well, let's answer that question first. The way it best prepared me, and look, I got lucky as well in terms of genetically who I was born, where I was born. I know I feel very lucky. My parents were you know, great people, lovely people, and I was born slightly more extrovert than introvert. I mean I'm about 50-50, but my extroversion enabled me to develop the ability to communicate and to be in relationship. I came from a very loving family. I grew up in a Christian household, which it could have been Christian or Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim. It didn't matter the particular religion. It was the interpretation of that religion that I grew up in, the values that I grew up in, which was love thy neighbor and be a nice person, basically, just be a kind person was how I grew up. And my parents were both socially well-adjusted. So I was lucky, right? So I've always been good in relationship. I've always been able to get along with anybody pretty much. And traveling around the world and living in lots of foreign different cultures and learning to connect and communicate across the superficial differences. So across the divide of language or religion or food or climate or, you know, conditions, those superficial differences, beneath those differences, what I found out is that we actually have deep, deep stuff in common, all of us. You know, apart from the literal metaphor of having the same color blood, which was pointed out to me by a beautifully devout Muslim man on a public bus in the Hindu Kush mountains of Pakistan back in 1998, just before the cruise missiles went in to try and kill Osama bin Laden in 98, so prior to 9/11. And this young Muslim man pointed that out to me as we were talking and sharing ideas. And he said, "We've got the same color blood, you and me. You know, we both care about our families. We care about our children. We both need food and shelter. We both need air and water. You know, we've actually got a lot more in common than we've got in difference," which was beautiful. And that stuck with me. And so it's a long way of answering your question, Kellen. But when I went into the business world and put on a shirt and tie, it was my ability to be able to connect with people, communicate with them in relationship and work together that was my success. And I had a very successful 8 years in a shirt and tie. And I ended up, you know, running a division of an international organization. My division was turning over $100 million a year. And, you know, I had 150 staff, et cetera. But that was only through my ability to communicate and form deep rapport with people. So that's how that bit happened. And in terms of being gifted land in the Himalaya, that didn't happen overnight either. So back in the 90s, when I was wandering around India, barefoot and dreadlocked, singing Kumbaya,
right.
Smoking weed, I stumbled across this family up in the Himalayan mountains, holy family in a village. We basically loved each other, and I lived with them for a long time, 6 months. And they adopted me into their family, and they've been my Himalayan family. I refer to them as my family. They've been my family ever since 1998. So we're only a couple of years shy of 30 years.
30. Wow.
And over the years of me running retreats there, I raised money to build a small school in the village. So we built a little school. We've been sponsoring some kids through school. As I've grown through my life, we've been able to sponsor more and more kids. So we're a part of the village. We put in a rubbish education collection program there. We've been educating the shepherds up in the Himalaya about non-biodegradable rubbish and how you can't just throw it into the mountains. We need to collect it and dispose of it properly, etc. And I'm a part of their family. And, you know, I've had kids since then. My brother has had kids since then. The kids haven't met yet in person, but they've met on WhatsApp video calls, and they
right.
will. And then just before COVID, the family said to me, "Jem, we'd like to give you 2 acres of our land in the forest here on the side of the mountain for you and Talia." Talia is my partner. And they were probably thinking that we would build ourselves a little mountain retreat home for ourselves. But we never had that vision. Immediately when they gifted us the land, I saw it as a gathering place, a non-profit meditation retreat center to bring great minds together to try and solve some of the world's bigger problems. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. This actual location is energetically stunning. It's a very healing location. The Mother Earth energy, the mountain energy is very strong, very feminine. All of the ancient deities there are all female. They're all goddesses. So there's a strong feminine energy. And it's very close to a place called Mount Kailash, just over the border in Tibet. So we're on the border with Tibet. Just over the border is Mount Kailash, which is one of the holiest mountains in the world. And apparently people say it's the crown chakra of the Earth's chakra system. So it's a very special place. And I never thought that the land would be just for us. That would be a shame. So we wanted to share it. And that has evolved over time to become an education sanctuary where we can run transformational programs for senior leaders.
So that's a marvelous story. Now I want to bring it back to the listeners here in this way. So you've told a story of polar, I won't even say opposites, a developmental story where you try different things, learn different things, and it's your success is centered around, you called it your ability, but I want to bring into the conversation the willingness, because a willingness to see the same color blood, the same needs, a willingness to ignore what is proclaimed loudly about the differences in the need and the acrimony, but to choose to accept more powerfully the sameness, the difference, the connection, the coherence that you called it. Because as you pointed out, everybody has it and knows it if they think about it, but most people, by and large, don't allow that resonance to speak. They push it aside or turn it down or do whatever. So if you're talking to an audience here, and you are, talk about what is important right now for a person who's hearing this and says, wow, I don't know exactly what to do with this, but I'm not going to ignore it. Like, help me. What would I do if I heard that and said, okay, now what?
So I'll share a very pragmatic, practical application of this concept of connection. Before I do, just to remind the listeners of some fundamental first principles of this existence, of life, of the universe, right? Of Earth and the planets rotating around the sun, and the sun being part of you know, the center of this solar system, which is a part of this galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy, which is a part of the universe. And there's tens of billions of galaxies that we know of. So the universe at large, some fundamental first principles are intimacy and difference. So whether you go down to the micro level of the intimacy of an atom, where you have a neutron and a proton and an electron, there is an intimacy there. The electrons that are circling around that proton, the neutron, there's an intimate relationship. Without the relationship between those two subatomic particles, the atom doesn't exist. And the intimacy can only exist, can only be bring life energy through the difference. The reason that the electron doesn't smush into the proton or the neutron is because there's a different charge between them. So the difference is important. It's the life energy that creates the difference on a micro. When you look at the macro level, you've got the sun and the planets that orbit around the sun. When you look at the Milky Way, you've got so it's on every level. When you look into a human-to-human relationship, the attraction or the charge between two humans who are sexually attracted to each other and want to procreate is because of the difference, the masculine energy, the feminine energy, right? And then we have so you've got the difference, which is important. And then you've got the intimacy, which is us together. We become a couple together. Right? So the fact that I can walk down the street and see someone who looks different to me, has a different accent or a different language, eats different food, worships God in a different way, that is beautiful and important. Without that difference, there is no life. But we are connected because without each other, we don't exist, us humans. And we are a species on a tiny little speck that's orbiting around one star that's one of a gazillion countless number of stars, and we are tiny, and we're all in this together. If a meteorite hits Earth and there's another mass extinction like there was with the dinosaurs, we all die together. It doesn't matter what color your skin is, and it doesn't matter whether you go to a mosque or a synagogue. It doesn't matter, right? So I hope, you know, and I know I'm not the only one, but I hope that we are evolving beyond scarcity. Scarcity is there's not enough resource, there's not enough land, so we have to fight each other, and you look different to me, so I'm going to fight against you for the resource. My hope is that we are evolving beyond that we do figure out abundance of resource, so we don't need to fight each other anymore, and that we can remember that the surface level differences are important, but they also are in conjunction with the deeper level connection that we're all in this together. Okay, sorry. Now, you asked me for a practical application of this. We are by nature closed-minded. Right? We have a way that we think things are, and we hold on to our way that we think things are. So when you're scrolling on social media, the reason the algorithms are programmed to put inflammatory material in front of you is because it fires your brain and you get defensive because you're defending your sense of the way you think things should be, and you click on it. You watch it and you click on it, and then you comment and go, no, I disagree, right? That's the way we're wired. We're very close-minded. Right. We're very opinionated. Immediately, I've got my opinion of what's right and wrong straight away. So here's my practical invitation for you. The next time you're scrolling on social media and you see something and you notice you have an opinion immediately, no, that's not right, or yes, that's right, pause, put your phone down, breathe just for 30 seconds, just deepen your breath, open your mind and consider alternative perspectives. Just consider them. I'm not saying you even need to change your mind. You might be pro-life and someone's pro-choice, or you might be anti-vax and someone's vax, right? I'm not saying you need to change your ideology. I'm just inviting you to sit for a couple of minutes and consider the alternative perspectives. That's all. And to remember that the people who are having these perspectives still have the same color blood as you, still need air and water, still need food and shelter, still grieve when a loved one dies. Just consider it. That's my invitation.
So I love that. And it has to start somewhere. And so what I would, in terms of agreeing with and emphasizing what Jem's talking about, like you can make a small difference. You know, we have a phrase, she made a mountain out of a molehill, which is a choice that in somebody's view, we took a small thing and blew it out of proportion. And we hear that thing all the time. Today in politics and religion, everything, we hear the word taken out of context, which is the same thing. And that is an invitation to consider without a requirement to change. Just consider. You know, there's a phrase, and I forgot who said it, but it goes like this. If you or if I had exactly the same set of experiences that this person over here did, wherein they are led to say or do a certain thing, that you or I would probably do the same thing. And you can disagree with that right now, but there's a very high likelihood that it's true. Those lenses, those glasses, the view that we have of things is shaped by our experience. So I love that. What kind of an experience do you create? Have you created at the retreats you've done? And are you creating at the center of love? And in that context, you can talk about more about the center of love and what you're building. But because this invitation to consider other possibilities, just to consider, is all you're saying, is part of this fundamental. So talk about the experiences you're creating that allow or invite people to do that. Mm. And then about this center of love.
Mm. So the experiences that we facilitate for people in the Himalaya in India, and similarly when we've run retreats in Bali over the years and in remote deserts of Australia, wherever they are, they need to be in extremely beautiful and majestic nature. That's an important component. And as far away from your natural, normal, daily routine / paradigm as possible, right? So you need to go on a bit of a hero's journey to get there. It can't be easy. It's very different. If you sign up to go to a retreat in a hotel in your local city, your local town, you can have some degree of experience. You might experience even some sense of slight transformation, quote unquote, but it's not truly transformational. For true transformation to take place, I believe that you need to remove yourself from your current paradigm. It's kind of like Dorothy going to Oz, right? You're not in Kansas anymore. There's that element to it. The concepts that we teach and share and talk about are not original. They're ancient, you know, ancient philosophical and conceptual understandings of existence through the human experience. What is it to be human? And so we guide people through conversations with models and methodologies at a conceptual philosophical level, but then most importantly, we guide people through practice to embody. So then it's through different meditations and body embodiment practices where we take concepts and start to feel them and experience them through meditation, through consciousness experience, and through embodiment. And then we intertwine that into immersion into stunning nature. And the Himalayan mountains where we walk, we get off the grid. It's not for everybody. We have pack horses carrying the gear. We are off the beaten path. There's no other people where we go. We're camping in tents. It's like I said, it's not, if you need 5-star, you don't want to come on one of these adventures with us. But if you're prepared to get uncomfortable, we take you back to the source of everything and a connection to source that is beyond ego, beyond separation, beyond self. And so it becomes a literally an embodied experience that is unforgettable. You can't then leave the retreat and pretend you didn't experience what you experienced, you know. And then we give the tools of integration. So, okay, I've had this meaning on the mountain, you know, coming to God moment. What do I do now, Jem? How do I go back to my job and how do I, you know, integrate this and implement that? And very importantly, we have a coaching program that is post-retreat, post-experience, to help people create daily 1% habitual practices that make sure that the understandings that they've come to are sustainable.
So you've mentioned several things that I want to just emphasize, and that is a situation that creates a large difference, a paradigm shift, the opportunity for a completely different view of something. And the second thing you said is to take it to a level of embodiment, and that's a word that I love. And for those listening that might not have a visceral understanding of that, I want you to think of it this way. If you go to a theater and you see a lion on a movie, it doesn't frighten you. If you're standing somewhere and suddenly there's a lion roaring at you, you have an embodied feeling of fear, like it is a real thing. That's the embodiment. So taking an experience and moving it from an intellectual understanding to a visceral body experience, which is all those neurotransmitters firing, accompanying whatever this sensation is it critical in this. And then what you said afterwards, I love, which is a follow-up program that allows for 1% incremental practices to get you steering in a direction. And that's a recipe, in any coaching or life-changing situation. It's a recipe for the creation of sustainable growth and directional, real directional shift. And so I really like that explanation.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Ultimately important. I mean, you can go to the Tony Robbins weekend and get into peak state and walk on the hot coals. I've done it. And I don't know what the percentage is, but I'm guessing it's 90% of the people don't then take the daily practices that were taught, that Tony shared in the, you know, whatever the weekend was that you went to. And I'm only using Tony Robbins because he's the most famous of this, but there's plenty of people doing the same thing. If you don't take those little 1% habitual practices and make them a part of your day-to-day life, you can walk on the hot coals and then a month later, nothing will have changed in your life. You know, you'll have a story to tell and that's it, but your life will not have changed. It is the implementation and the creation of habitual practices. So they don't become a chore or a task. They become just a way of you being in your daily way of being, you know, and the 1% changes over a long period of time make the biggest difference. You know, the analogy is teeing off on a golf course and hitting a golf ball, and the face of the driver of your golf club could be just 1% a little bit askew, and you might not even notice that 1% angle change in the moment, but when you hit that golf ball over the duration of its flight, it ends up two fairways across to the right because you sliced it, okay? So the 1% difference now makes a big difference over the long period of time, and that's why these little 1% habitual practices, like a morning routine, a morning meditation or affirmation routine, or, you know, eating just a little bit healthier now today, just a little bit, doesn't make a difference. Do I say yes or no to that ice cream? Doesn't make a difference right now. But if I say yes to ice cream every single day for the rest of my life, it makes a difference, right? So, yeah, anyway, yeah, I think it's important.
So I've asked you a lot of questions and led this all over the place, and you've given us spectacular things. But you're a world-class change agent. And I say that without any hesitation. So what topic or information or encouragement or truth-telling do you want the large number of people that see this to understand and to potentially consider, like you talked about that considering something? So what haven't I asked you about that is near and dear to your heart that we ought to cover?
Look, I think if you feel in any way inclined or motivated or curious about what can I do to make anything just a little bit better, if you feel at all inclined, how can I make my family's life a little bit better? Or how can I help my community? What can I do? Or even if some of you might even feel, how can I have a bigger difference? What can I do beyond my local community to try and help make the world a better place? I'm going to share something with you that you've heard before. And I'm going to share it again because it's true. It's got to start with you. How do you improve your relationship with self? Right? Now, this is not narcissistic if it's to help you become a better person so that you're more effective in the big wide world, i.e. your relationship with your partner or your children or your family or your community, right? Or the globe. If the work that you do on yourself is such that you can be a better person to be more effective outwardly, then it's not narcissistic, but it is the place to start, you know? And you can even, if just to take one example, start to be curious about the quality of the dialogue, the quality of the words that you use when you are talking to yourself. We all have this internal narration going on. Whenever you're not in communication with someone else or absorbed in a television show, whenever you're walking from A to B, there's a narration going on, right? What is the quality of the words like when you're in communication with yourself, especially if you're reprimanding yourself, if you are not happy with yourself? Be observant of the quality of the words that you choose to use, because quite often we are downright abusive to ourselves. We cuss and swear and we put ourselves down when we're not feeling good about ourselves. You know, if you're not happy with yourself, when you get out of the shower and you're standing in front of the mirror, what's the quality of the words that you say? Are you saying, I hate myself, or I hate my body, or I'm so stupid, or I'm an idiot, or what a fool? The quality of this language is a big part of determining the quality of your relationship with self. You wouldn't talk to your children like that. Well, I hope you wouldn't. You wouldn't talk to a loved one like that. I hope you wouldn't. And so start to improve the quality of the internal dialogue. Now, you can still hold yourself to account. You can still aspire to be the best version of you. You can still, you know, when you make a mistake, you can still coach yourself to be better next time, but you can do it positively and constructively. That's my invitation.
So I love that. And in exact alignment with the gentleness that you described about yourself earlier in the program, that is very consistent with that. Here's another way to think about that. you can't love anybody else more than you love yourself. So, and I'd state that without apology. And that's not as nice as Jim just said it. But the truth is, if you can't speak kindly and lovingly to yourself, I don't care, you can go through the motions, but the truth of the energetic transmission is not there. So the only place that you can start that is long-term and sustainable and that matters is in your own heart. You can't love somebody else and hate yourself. The creation of a divine being is just as applicable to you. And so that is a serious and beautiful thought and admonition that we've just received. And it's absolutely true. Can you imagine how much more effective and joyful your day would be if you were nice, kind, encouraging, joyful to yourself, not letting things slide, not lazy. We're not talking about any of that crap. Just if you chose to be encouraging, uplifting, visionary, and positive, what do you think would happen? Jim, if we got 10,000 people to change from neutral or negative dialogue to encouraging and powerful and upliftment, just in their communication with themselves, what do you think would happen?
Well, there's 10,000 people who would be much nicer to be around. And if they have 10 people around them, there's 100,000 people whose lives are better. And heaven forbid the ripples become waves and the 100,000 people becomes a million and so on. So the Buddhist philosophy of it starts with you. In fact, your only responsibility is to curate the quality of your relationship with yourself. Holds true in that case. And I want to throw this in there as well, because this will challenge some people also. If you are religious or spiritual, so if you're religious, call it God. If you're spiritual, call it source or consciousness or the field. Insert whatever word you want. The only way you can experience God is through your experience of God. And your experience of God is flavored by your internal world, your state of being. if your state of being is has static, if it's not clear and clean, if it has muck in it, you can only experience that version of God. No matter how pure you think God is, you can't experience pure God if you're not clean inside. So if you want to experience the cleanliness of source, if you want to experience the godliness of the field of energy, of consciousness, then you need to do the self-love work. Otherwise, you can't experience God in its pure form.
I love that. And thanks for saying it. And I hope it challenges the crap out of some people. So if somebody wants to find out more about GEM or more about your love project or more about programs or books or things that you have, where do they go? Because you've shared some powerful things. There's not a single thing that you've said that I have the slightest issue with. And more importantly, the timing. The time is now. The need is growing. AI and its changes are now. So whether you think you're going to be out of a job or not, how about if it's just time to create the upliftment of the species and end the divisive energy? Anyway, tell us where to find out about you.
GEM Fuller with a J, GEMFULLER everywhere. So you can find me on Instagram, GEM Fuller, LinkedIn, GEM Fuller, Facebook, GEM Fuller. GEMFuller.com is a website. Now, the nonprofit global movement is the Center of Love. TheCenterOfLove.org is our website. And you can find my retreats and everything through that as well. I'm still accessible, folks. If you want to have a conversation with me, you can reach out through any of those platforms, Instagram or wherever. And on the Instagram in the profile, there's the Linktree thing with all the links to the latest bits and pieces. So yeah, you can find me pretty easily.
I love that. And I love your name is GEM with a J. Do you know any other GEMs with a J?
I have met a couple through my life. I'm not in touch with them at the moment. Quite often when people get introduced to me before knowing whether I'm male or female, they presume I'm GEM, maybe because of the Barbie doll GEM. Back in the 70s. And some people presume I'm a woman, and then they hear my voice and realize that I'm not. But I don't hang out with any other GEMs.
Well, you know, when you have a name like Kellen Flukiger, you know, you pay attention to all that stuff. I saw your name, GEM, and I loved the fact that it was different.
Yep.
GEM, you bring a special spirit, and the fact that he has invited you to get a hold of him is a special thing. So do it. Like the experiences that he has had, the journey that he shared is powerful. And you have an opportunity right now to ask yourself that question. I wonder if there's something else, something more. What does 1% look like? There's a dude that was flying jets and he talked about 90% of the time the plane's off course, because they're gradually correcting it all the time because of wind and movement. And if you don't, like if you're less than 1% off course and you fly for 3 or 4 hours, which isn't a very long flight, you're friggin' miles. You're in another country, you know? And so that's absolutely true, and it happens. So I want to encourage you. GEM, thank you for your spirit, for your heart, for your love, and for all that you are doing to add good to the world.
Kellen, mirror, it's really been so lovely to meet you and connect with you. And I love what you're doing, your books, your time, the energy you put into what you're doing for the greater good. So I feel honored to have been asked to come and have a conversation with you.
Well, likewise. So that's really good. I want to thank you for being here with the show. And listeners, I want to encourage you one more time to take advantage of the opportunity to go back through this. Like, and look him up, gemfuller.com, thecenteroflove.org. Like, this is a global movement, and you know already it's time. You're feeling it in your heart. You're feeling it in your bones. So don't push it away. Don't say when I'm ready. Don't say some other time. It's not time to do that. The time is now. The opportunity is now. And I promise you, this effort to love yourself more, to change your direction and your dialogue, just 1% will pay big dividends as you choose to move forward and create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.